Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits.
Are you thinking about getting into Dungeons & Dragons? Maybe you're looking to expand your horizons as a DM or a player. If that's the case, then it's time for you to check out The Dungeon Cast, the best D&D podcast out there that helps you passively learn all about the game just by listening. Join co-hosts Will and Brian as they break down the lore of a rich multiverse 50 years in the making in a lighthearted and beginner-friendly way. They cover everything from character creation options to tips for dungeon masters. There's something for everyone, no matter how long you've been playing TTRPGs. Find The Dungeon Cast anywhere you get podcasts or on YouTube.
Hello world and welcome back to another episode of Thanks for Coming In. I'm your host, Jillian Clare. If this is your first time listening to the show, welcome. So nice to have you around, and hit that subscribe button if you like what you hear. Today on the show, we have Jason Stewart. You may know his face from Tangerine or The Birth of a Nation. He's also an incredible writer and author and everything. He does it all and great comedian as well. So here is my conversation with Jason Stewart. And welcome to the show, Jason Stewart.
Hello.
How are you on this fine day?
Oh, just, you know, I'm grateful, I'm happy, I'm suicidal, I'm crazy, I'm anxious, I'm positive, I'm open, I'm closed. I'm a mother and a sister, I'm Faye Dunaway in Chinatown.
Wow. Well, that's a lot to feel in one day, but that's very me. Human that's of
me.
You.
That's me. Very human. Every day.
I love that. So I was looking at your IMDb and your website before getting on here. And
Thank you so much.
Well, you've just been on everything, and it seems like you're constantly working, whether it be on film and television or doing activism or, you know, doing your stand-up. What got you into this industry? What made you say, like, I need to entertain people?
Oh God, I was so young. I was 8 or 9, and I used to watch I Love Lucy, you know, obsessively on television, and I thought it was so funny, and I wanted to be like that. I mean, I actually fell in love with all the people on television. They were sort of like my family. And I remember there was this thing called the Fall Preview Show. It was a half-hour show they would do and tell you what would be on for the next season. And I remember my family had gone up to Big Bear for a short vacation, and it was snowing. And in those days, you know, sometimes TV would just go off, and you didn't have the antennas to get it right. And I was obsessed with being able to watch that show because I didn't know who my family was going to be for the next year. And that's how crazy I was as a kid. I think I just didn't want to be me. Whoever I was, I didn't want to be me. You know, a little gay kid growing up in a crazy family with a father that was a Holocaust survivor and a mother from Brooklyn who was dirt poor, who'd got married when they were very young. My mom was 17. My dad was 22. Wow. And, you know, they didn't really want to be married to each other. They were so young, pregnant and all that kind of stuff. And that was 1955, you know, it was just sort of crazy. And, you know, there was no place for me. I was looking for my spot. I was looking for someone to call my name. Mm. And then I remember that I did a play in my temple. I did community theater and school plays, and and the recreation play hall plays. And I remember I did a play called Santa Claus for President, and I played Santa Claus. I think it's because I was the tallest kid or the most aggressive. I still don't know why they chose me. And I remember I did the whole play as if I were Lucille Ball pregnant, because I had this fat suit on to be Santa.
Oh my gosh.
So I remember how funny it was when she was in the chair and trying to get up and all the things she did. And I got all these laughs. And I remember Meyer Levine, who was the director of the center and the director of the play, came over to me and he said, you want to do this, don't you, when you grow up? And I said, yes. And I was 14. Mm. And that's when I started studying acting professionally after that.
Wow. Well, first off, that your family story sounds so interesting. Like, you should write a book about it.
Well, I did. It's called Shut Up, I'm Talking.
There we go.
And it came
there
out.
There we go.
Yes, it's called Shut Up, I'm Talking, coming out in Hollywood and Making It to the Middle, which is available on my website through CCB Publishing or on Amazon and all the other places you can buy books. And
it's
done nicely. It's done nicely. And if you like hearing me talk, I always say that's the way the book is.
Oh, see, I love that. When you're reading a book and you can hear the author's voice. I remember the first time I read an Anthony Bourdain book, and it was like, oh, that is so clearly him. No one else could have written this.
Yes. I mean, I wrote it with somebody. The way I wrote it originally was on Skype, and there was a guy who's a radio producer, who's a radio show I used to do all the time called the Stephen DC Show in St. Louis. And he had written a book called The Half Book. And he had, this great guy, a Catholic, had gotten skin cancer. And he talked about how he recovered from it and how his whole family, what happened to his family and everything. And the book was funny and touching. And I said, this is exactly the way, you know, I'd like my book to be. I wish I could find someone like you, I said to him, to write it. He said, I'd love to. And then So for a year, I told him the stories. He wrote them down. He sent them back to me. I rewrote them. We wrote them together.
Yeah.
And then one weekend, I flew him to Los Angeles, and we spent the weekend, Friday to Monday, together and finished the book.
That's incredible. Wow. You're an author, too. What can't you do?
One thing I learned from my dad is that if you can't do something well, get someone who's great at it to help you. Find the person that does what you do or want to accomplish who's better than you.
That's very smart advice. I feel like that's really good advice too for independent filmmakers, because I feel like a lot of times indie filmmakers, myself included, can put on too many hats and try to do too many things, when in reality it's going to be a lot better if you hire the people who are really good at what they do. And everyone creates together as a collaboration.
A lot of times you don't have the money. That's the problem.
Yeah, that's the biggest problem.
Money is always the problem, because wouldn't it be an interesting world if money wasn't the problem and people just did things because
it would be so great.
It would change the whole concept of the way we walked around in life.
Yeah. So going back to, finding your passion when you were a teen, what was your first steps after high school? Did you go to college for it? Did you move somewhere specifically for it?
I was crazy. So I was also a gay kid growing up, you know, in a time when people that were gay were basically shunned, and it's so different than your generation. I don't even know how to explain to you. I always think about it this way, that if you're in the closet, it's like you're standing on the shoes, you're behind the clothes, you know, every once in a while, somebody opens up a door, shines a light in your face, takes something out and slams the door shut. And that's how you make all your decisions. Mm. That's who I was. You know, there was hat boxes and shit in the way. And, you know, I didn't see anything clearly. So that's how I did it. So when I was 17, probably when I went into high school, which was around 15, I had decided that I was going to figure out how to get out of high school as quickly as I could. So I got out of high school in 2.5 years. I got my own apartment when I was 18. I had just been 18 for 2 months. I got a job working in an answering service. and I started to pursue my career, what I would do is I would send my picture and resume to everybody that I could find. And I wrote, I'm a young character actor. I just did this film for USC, which I had done with this guy who was in my acting class. And I had done nothing. I mean, I had no credits. I'd done this theater, mm-hmm. you know, and then the first person that met me was Pam Dixon, who was the head of casting at ABC. And I remember going in there, I remember what I was wearing. I remember wow. the interview. And I remember being shunned constantly, not by her specifically, but by almost everyone because of who I was. I think that I read as a young gay person and I didn't know who I was. I remember, you know, as a kid that if you fell in love with Robert Redford, who were you left to be with Barbara Streisand? Do you know what I mean? You didn't have any picture of who you could be and who your personality was. And you weren't able to grow as a human being in the same way. And that's all in the book called Shut Up, I'm Talking.
Read it more. Wow, I can't imagine that because my generation has been so lucky. And it's because your generation went through the worst of it.
That makes me emotional. Thank you.
Yeah.
That's so important for me to hear. Because a lot of people don't say that. And I say it all the time that I am standing on the shoulders of so many other people that walk before me. And that's so important to me. And I say their names all the time. People like Bruce Valanche and Robin Tyler and people who just walk the walk. And some of them didn't have, you know, big careers because of it.
Yeah.
You know? And some of them, you know, completely... Yeah. Lost who they were. And I realized that as I became a comedian because I couldn't get a job as an actor. This is earlier than when you probably out of your order of questions, but I went to the open call for The Outsiders and Rumblefish, the film Coppola was directing of those children's books. And I thought, this is perfect for me. I am a character actor. I can go in and be this. And I remember what I wore. I wore a vest and a shirt, a collarless shirt with jeans and cowboy boots, and I had my hair parted down the middle and it was layered and I was cute. And I remember walking in and they just completely dismissed me. I was completely dismissed. I wasn't, a soch, and I wasn't a biker kid or whatever the other kids were called. And I wasn't, and no one was willing to look a little deeper or say, maybe one of the kids was a gay kid, or maybe one of, you know, maybe somebody was a little different. Nobody was, there was no willingness or openness to that. And it broke me. All that kind of stuff broke me. It broke me. And I walked around like a broken dish trying to figure out who I was. And I was funny. The comedy helped me and I became a comedian. And then that's what saved me. But no matter, every time I go back and I say my career, you know, our careers go up and down and up and down. And whenever there's a down, I go, what do I really want to do? Who do I really want to be? And I always wanted to be a great character actor. That's where my, you know, love is. Mm. Even my stand-up is somewhat of a character. It's really not me anymore.
Wow. What was the first job that you had on a set where you felt like you were being accepted?
Well, the first job I did was a show called Life and Times of Eddie Roberts. It was a nighttime comedy soap opera. And I played a pot-smoking ping-pong player. I believe I was in high school. I was 19 when I did it. It was four scenes. It was a guest star. And I thought that was it. I thought I was going to get, you know, I was going to get these parts. I dropped out of college, community college, because I never went to regular college because I was too scared. I was afraid to be in college because I was afraid that I was going to meet the same kids in high school. I was so in my own head. I never talked about anything. I never talked about the physical abuse or the mental abuse of going through school and what it did to me, because if I said it out loud, then I would have to admit that it happened and that I was humiliated.
You have to deal with it.
Hey, I'm a black person and they treat me badly. Hey, I'm a Latin person. They treat me badly. Hey, I'm a woman, but you can't say, hey, I'm a gay person, because then they'll say you're gay. And it's even, you know, even now, even though, gay people are so much more accepted, especially in the last 10 years. There, you know, somebody knows you in one way, you still get limited to what they think you can play a lot of times. And it's natural that people do that because you only, if you can't see it, then, you know, some people can't see past things, or they can't see a gay person being in a powerful position. They see them being is more of, you know, a victim, and there aren't very many parts for gay people over 50. They just aren't. So, I forgot where we were. I totally got lost.
the first show that you did.
That was the first show that, and the first movie I did was a movie called The Lost Emperor, not The Last Emperor, not the Bertolucci film. The Lost. It was an exploitation film that Jim Minarski directed. Robert Tessier was the star. You probably, older people might remember him as being one of the stars of the movie, The Longest Yard with Burt Reynolds. He was the bald guy in it. And in our movie, they kept putting eyebrows on him, and they kept, I don't know why, but they were different in every shot. I play gay dude number one. I swear to God, my manager got me this part by having lunch with this guy. I had a manager who I talked into managing me after she saw me in a showcase, and I worked part-time in her office trying to get her to stop drinking and spending her money. And we went and I thought, oh, I'm going to be, I told everyone I'm playing this character role. I'm going to be a gay guy and a thing. And my one line was, give me back my purse. And he said to me, I'm being mugged in the film. And he said to me, wear a very blousy flamboyant shirt. So I brought a very blousy flamboyant shirt. And he said, no, this is all wrong. You know, and then he looked at the makeup girl and he said, you switch shirts with him. She was wearing a little top that was striped, blue stripes going across it. It was two sizes too small for me. I look like Philip Seymour Hoffman in Boogie Nights. It was probably one of the most degrading, experiences. And I thought, he also wanted me to wear an ascot. And I said, look, I'm not Thurston Howell III on Gilligan's Island. It's the 80s,
Right.
And I talked him out of that. But that's the way my career went for a very long time. The second job I got was on the Nickelodeon, playing a butler to a dog. You know what I mean? I just didn't have, there was no place for me.
Wow.
So I started doing stand-up and I was funny. And then I started getting work. And then I went on Star Search. And I won an episode. And then I started traveling. And then by Star Search.
I forgot about that show.
Oh, yeah. I won one episode and I lost one to Martin Lawrence. And if you go online, you can see me and Martin Lawrence. I stamp my foot and I walk off when I lose. I thought that would be really funny. And in the day it was, but then on YouTube, and it's years have passed, people have said some pretty awful things about me on that.
Oh, the internet. Always the best place. What was I going to say? I'm in awe of your story and very inspired. And I hope that people who are listening to this talk actually truly, truly listen to it. Because I feel like there's a lot of really good life lessons that you've been talking about. And I think it's important for us, especially in the entertainment industry. Like you said, it's been getting better in the past 10 years. But I think it's really important for us to consistently remember the past, so that we don't repeat that, and so that we're being open-minded in casting processes, in producing, and things that we're doing constantly. I think it's really important for us to remember how it has been so that we can make it better.
You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales, because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea – Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Well, there's a certain, you know, women have done something in the last 5 years with the Me Too moment movement that has really changed the fabric of how we do things. And women, you know, it's not a simple thing. You know, when I was a kid, every movie you saw, there was a beautiful woman and then there was this guy that wanted to get with her. And she was not interested in him at all, said no a million times. And by the end of the movie, they were together.
You know, it's the enemies to lovers trope.
Right, which is exactly what the Me Too movement is sort of about. Look at Grease, the movie that is considered one of the biggest family movies of all time. He has an affair with her in the summer. She goes on a date with him when they get to high school. He comes on to her and gropes her in the car and grabs her and tries to molest her. She says no. They sing Summer Nights. She obviously, by the end of the movie, has sex with him and wears black, comes back, and then she's in. And they say, and the song is, "You're the One I Want," you know, ooh, ooh, ooh. So right. I mean, their whole movie is about date rape. I mean, you know, I'm ruining everybody's thing, but I mean, that's what that movie is about. So the confusingness in life now of where everything is at, and where you take it to casting, you know, you take it that a certain kind of woman, a certain kind of man, the way people look, that of what we consider attractive and sexual and wanting to cast, and the ones that are and the ones that aren't, you know, women like to be so thin now, you know, whereas a lot of men or a lot of people don't find that attractive, but yet it's told in the movies that it is.
Yeah.
That sort of thin, boyishy kind of body that, you know, and or with fake boobs or not, or with not, you know, what we're doing now is the whole idea of how we're casting things and what we see and what is what and who can play what to who, you know, and how your career goes. It's all up for grabs right now. I think it's all completely, it's changed the whole landscape of how things are being done and what's attractive, what isn't, what's a romantic lead, what isn't a romantic lead, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I agree. I was reading Kate Winslet has been really vocal about not
who is that?
Wanting to Kate Winslet.
Oh, Kate Winslet.
She's been very vocal about not caking on makeup and being real and portraying women in a real light rather than this like sexualized version of them all the time. And that's what I loved with watching her show, Mayor of Easttown, that just was on HBO. You could see that it was raw. It looked raw. It looked real. And it didn't have that, oh, let me put on my fake eyelashes bull crap that I'm sick of seeing. It's like, I don't need to see another woman flash her eyelashes for me to think
unless
she's pretty.
That's part of the character. Unless like when Julia
Roberts unless played, it's the thing.
When Julia Roberts was in 20 years ago and did Erin Brockovich, that was a woman who liked to look very sexual and was in a very powerful position. And that was her choice. And she even said it. You know, and if it's part of the character, and if you really watched Mayor of Easttown very closely, she did wear makeup in it, and
she wore it, but it wasn't like it wasn't was that wearing, like caked on thing.
No, and she was wearing a wig.
Was that a wig? I was wondering because like
I'm a sort of wig expert.
Are you?
Because I used to wear hair pieces when I was younger because I lost my hair so young. So but I didn't wear hair pieces. I wore wigs that were from the studio with the lace fronts and everything. And hers was one of the best I've ever seen. But you notice those two strands of hair in the front would always hang and they didn't seem connected to the other. That's when you can know, you know. And then you saw her in other things when she was younger in the film and she had blonde hair. Mm-hmm. Completely, that was her real hair, you know. But I'm sure Kate Winslet, people probably, she still wants to be attractive. What I think she's saying is, to be more nuanced, is that it's okay to age on camera. You don't have to be plastic surgeried out,
right?
You know.
Well, and I talk about that with my best friend a lot. We talk about how plastic surgery, especially for women, I think can really ruin a career. Because I can't play a 60-year-old woman when I'm 60 if I've had a crap ton of plastic surgery. Like, it's not going to look right. And it's not going to be for the character. Maybe if it was, you know, a woman who lived in the OC and was really rich and whatever, sure. But it's not going to be the real characters that actors
Well, you limit your casting very much so. But yet, my mom was 84, will always look at somebody. She says, how can that woman be the same age as me? I said, Ma, she's had it all done. She's Botox and, you know, plumped and everything, you know. They're all doing this. It's just crazy.
Oh, gosh. Well, on this show, we like to share audition stories that have either gone awry or things that have gone good. What do you have an audition story that you would like to share listeners?
So many. I'll give you one real quick one first. I'll give you a couple. Little ones. So I remember going in to when they were taping me for something, and someone your age, I'm assuming you're in your 20s, right? Mm-hmm. And they just start, and then they go, okay, and they walk in the room and they just start. And I said, hold on, I'm not even in the room yet. You know, let's give me a second to, you know, there's sometimes people are completely so in their own day. So I say for people who are actors, listen to this. You can say, hey, hold on a second, you know, and you can take your power. Yeah. And people are always worried about being too nice. I'm listening to Clubhouse all the time these days, and you listen to a lot of the casting rooms. And there seems to be so much about making the casting director, the producer, director on a pedestal rather than just making them people who you're just people you're working with. They're your peers, you know. Mm-hmm. And there is something said to the idea. I have a manager who now says that I'm too nice, I'm too easy, I compromise too much. And, you know, that and now I start to say no to things, which I never did before. But some really bad auditions, I guess, are funny. I was auditioning once for, I think it was a TV pilot. And I had left, well, I don't want to tell you, I had gone in red, and then I left. I said, thank you very much. And then they chased me out. And that's my fantasy. That's my fantasy, is to be chased after my audition when I leave. And I just walk out and they chase down the hall and they say, I want that boy. You know, and then the whole camera freezes and I get the part. Well, they didn't. They had just forgotten. I had just forgotten my briefcase of pictures and resumes. That's how they said, here, take
it. Oh, no.
Yeah. I think some Joyce Selznick, who was a very big head of one of the networks, I had gone in for one of the many pilots they tried to do of the Archie comic book. I walked in. She was wearing glasses. I'll let you see. They can't see. She was wearing glasses like this, reader glasses. And she was looking at something. And she looked up at me and she said, too old. And that was it. And I turned around and I walked into the closet.
What?
I walked into the closet because I was so nervous. And I said, and she said, Jason, come out of the closet. And that was the beginning of how my career started. I've gone and read for a lot of people who didn't really want to read me. That's the story. They didn't really want to read me and really didn't think I could do stuff. And I could feel it. That my agent or manager or some friend who was a producer had pushed, to get me in on things. And I have to say that I've gotten a lot of those parts, but that's always really hard. Really hard to that idea. And I've also been in the position where someone has a really big writer, producer, director 2 years ago suggested me for a part on his series. I won't say who it was. But when I got there, the casting directors couldn't have been more not. It was like, oh my God, who am I? And it was my part to lose. So it's happened the other way too. I think sometimes when there was one casting director who used to cast a very popular sitcom. And I remember I moved the chair. She says, don't touch the chair. Just like that. That's exactly what? I remember things like that. When you're doing stuff, can pull you out of stuff. So, but I didn't know that at the time. I didn't know that if somebody's tone or something could pull you out of something. And these are all little actor things, that you have to make sure you've eaten before you go to an audition. Make sure you're rested. Make sure you're focused and you're in the moment. If you don't really want to talk to someone, say, hey, I'd like to read first, and then we can talk. You can say what you want to say. Most of the time. Yeah. They want you to. They want you to be the one. They want their job to be done. I would guess.
Right. Right. They want to be able to go to the director and say, "Hey, I found the person. Let's move on."
I had one casting director who I know socially, and every time I've gone in, she would just line read me to death, and And once I went into one of her auditions, and this was probably, it's got to be 10 or 12 years ago, and I've seen her socially since, and she's a lovely gal. And I remember she said, well, we didn't know whether we thought you were great, but we didn't know how to hire you because we thought you were just so funny in the room. We didn't think we thought that you would be out of control on the set. And I decided to go in the room and not let her. And I was funny from the beginning to the get go. It's just trying to do something very different and just sort of, take hold of the room rather than be apologetic. So I went way the other way. But, instead of calling and giving me the part, why couldn't she just say, hey, when you come to the set, oh, of course, I was just trying to, do this. There's no, a lot of times there's no conversation. Right. I was on a sitcom that this was 15 years ago. And there was I was a guest star. It was two scenes. And I played a shop owner of a little boutique. And it was a gay part. And I'd gotten the part from every gay guy in Hollywood. It was there. Even the late Rip Taylor was there. I believe who was in the room, if I remember correctly, was Patrick Bristow, Alec Mappa, myself, somebody else. I think it was maybe Drew Droege. I can't remember. But all these gay guys from, 30s to 60s were in this room. And I got the part. I went on the set. Did the table read, they laughed hysterically. Then we had a reading for the producers on a Tuesday, which on a sitcom, which they never do. It was unusual.
No, that's
and
weird.
And we were all sort of awkwardly doing it. And there were some laughs. And then the next day I got called, I was fired.
What?
And they said they decided they were going another way. And it was devastating to me. No one called me and said, hey, can you play this a different way? We've decided the part is going to go this way. No one ever gave me an opportunity. They just said, you're gone. And what I heard earlier by the director of the show 3 weeks later is that they decided to go with somebody they decided to go another way. And some the director told me that one of the producers on the show had a bug up his ass that he didn't want a gay guy to be on the show. Yet it was a gay part, that he didn't want the gay character on it. And it's funny, one of the consulting producers was a writing partner of mine at one time. She never called me. Mm. One of the stars of the show was a comedian friend of mine, and she was the only one that called me that day. And I'll never forget her for that. And the way the casting director thanked me, do you remember the movie When a Man Loves a Woman with Meg Ryan and mm-hmm. Andy Garcia? Well, she's so drunk that she leaves her kid at the cleaners and gets home and realizes she doesn't have her kid with her. And then they looked up her credit card. They found the thing. They went to her house. They brought her the kid. She was panicked, right? And the way she thanked her was to never go mm-hmm. back to that store. Well, that's what that casting director did. They never called me in again until this year. They called me in for a co-starring role, which I almost turned down the audition because I don't want to do, you know, co-stars, but it was a real fun part. But that's what happened. People get so embarrassed, so unable to communicate. And I don't think they did it maliciously in any way, shape, or form. Mm-mm. I just think there's so many people that can't pick up the phone and say, hey, this is what happened. Or can you do this differently? And I would go, sure.
Yeah. That's our job as actors, is to be directed and told what to do but, you know, given that direction so that we can make it what the creators want it to be.
This was 15, 16 years ago, not for a gay person. Once you're gay, you're gay. And I was known for being an openly gay comedian, and I can understand why they would feel that, because mm-hmm. that's all they knew of me. And I had played tons of gay parts. I was the gay shrink on My Wife and Kids. I played the gay manager on Will and Grace. I had done all, you know, Norm's show. I played the ex-gay guy. I mean, I'd done it on all these shows, but I was not able to get a series, or I had 10 different deals for series. But, you know, finally somebody said to me, look, there's no way a gay guy who is a gay guy is going to get that part. You know, I mean, Sean Hayes, who was on Will and Grace for whatever the 8 years that they were on, was in the closet the whole time. He refused to say he was gay in public. And he later apologized for that when he got an award at GLAAD, which I thought was tremendous. You know, he realized when he got out of the closet, the power of it, and how being in had hurt other people and hurt the movement. Though he was on the most popular gay show on television, that was such, and his portrayal and his work, everybody also thought he was out. That's what was so interesting, the dichotomy of that. Everybody would say, oh, he's never said it, you know, and he would be the only one, you know, he was the only gay person in his cast of a gay show.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no mistake that they chose Eric McCormick. You know, Harvey Milk always said, a gay guy in power. Ah, that's scary. That's a quote that I'm probably saying wrong, but that was a quote. There's the power of us having opinions about who we are and how we're going to do things. You know, when I read Sharon Stone's book, who I had known a teeny bit from my acting teacher, Roy London, you know, very powerful woman. But when at the height of her fame, she was not offered the parts that somebody like her. So she tried to create her own things and did her own stuff, you know, because she had to show people that she just wasn't this sex bombshell, that she could do other things. And she did.
Yeah.
You know, you have to take, you know, people, for actors at home going, oh, well, they're not, you know, they're thinking that I'm this or that. Well, you need to do low budget films, student films, shorts, and create work so you can say, hey, look what I can do. And that's what I started to do 10 or 12 years ago after getting off the road in nightclubs.
Right.
That's what I started to do.
And you have a show called Smothered that you wrote and acted in. Is that right?
Yes. I created a show called Smothered, which is about these two guys who have been in a relationship for 30 years who hate each other but can't afford to get divorced. And what's so funny is my manager said the other day, now people are going to think about you being gay again, because 4 years ago I was in the movie Birth of a Nation, where I played a white heterosexual Christian plantation owner in 1831. So, you know, he said, but now because of everything, it's I can go back to doing funny things, and people still know that I can do more than that. I'm not a one trick pony. This character is such a victim. I've never played a character like this, gay or straight. Someone that just completely is sort of a dim bulb and stuff. And we are actually being considered for an Emmy nomination for short form. We're on the list to be nominated. So if anybody is a TV Academy member, we're for your consideration. So, which was really just, shocking. I couldn't believe that it worked out. It's 7 5-minute episodes, and it's on Amazon, but you can also watch it on a lot of other platforms by going to smothertv.com if you don't have Amazon.
Yay. Well, thank you so much, Jason, for coming on the show. This has been a very beautiful conversation. I don't think I've ever had such a deep talk on this show before. And I
really? Oh my.
It's very important.
My voice went up so high.
I've talked about, drug addiction issues with somebody who was on the show a few months ago and what his struggle was. And, we've talked about other issues within the industry before, but I feel like this has been the most heartfelt one with the biggest lessons. And so I thank you for that, because I think it's really important for us to talk about this and for people to learn a little and listen and, keep their ears open.
Well, I'll leave you with this. So for those people out there who people think are a one trick pony, and that that their stereotype, whoever they are, they think is limited, or they want to do more than just that. I worked really, really hard. I kept showing up. I went back to class. I worked on playing different kinds of characters. I saw an ad in the paper that said they were shooting films for tax breaks all over the country. I got a New Orleans agent, and I got a part in a movie called The Birth of a Nation, where I played a slave owner, a major supporting role with 8 scenes. I went to Sundance with it. I went to Montreal Comedy Festival, TIFF Film Festival. And that part changed my life. I finally got to be in a movie with a part that was important to the film, and also important to the story, and working with people who raised me up, and the kind of film that I wanted to be a part of, the life story of Nat Turner, that when people went to the movie theater, it changed their way of thinking. And that was my dream. Not that the other films that I did, there were comedies that were not wonderful, that made people laugh, where I had nice supporting roles. But this one really held special to me as a human, that someone can go into the movie theater, like I did as a kid, look at something and see something completely different and be so moved by it. And I say it this way, keep showing up.
Mm-hmm.
That's half the battle. Even if you're scared, I'm uncomfortable and nervous and scared all the time.
Yeah.
You know, it's okay.
I love that. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Where can people follow you on social media to keep up with your show and your work and your books?
Go to jasonstewart.com, STUART, and all my social media is there. You can click on everything very easily. You don't have to look at anything, because some of them is the JasonStewart_, and everything is right there.
Right.
So it's easier to go to one place, and you can see clips. You can buy my book. You can buy my new comedy CD. You can read about what's happening next, or you can just send me an email and say, hey, what's going on? I answer all my own stuff.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. I'm excited to see what you do next. And thank you for being such an inspiring actor and person and activist, and for, keeping a smile on people's faces.
Well, thank you, Jillian. I appreciate that. And thanks for having me on the show and seeking me out.
Thank you again to Jason for coming on the show and talking with me. We don't have many conversations on the show that are so open and enlightening and powerful. So it was a great joy to be able to share in that today with you. Make sure to subscribe to the show and wherever you're listening to it right now, and follow us on social media. We post some really fun stuff over there. And as always, Thanks for coming in.
Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Buntwine, erstwhile monk turned traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Buntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.